Welcome to our 330 minutes, a special edition with our first time with our hot dog roller. Glad to see everyone's enjoying it. And Moshe already calls next week for sauerkraut and French fries. So I'm just pointing that out there, but I'm hoping everyone's enjoying their hot dogs. Of course, the same way there's no calories on Shabbos, so too hot dogs don't count when you come for Torah. The ruchnius outweighs the gashmius. That is how it works. Okay, so we also have Torah in addition to hot dogs tonight. We have three ideas in 30 minutes. The first idea comes from a gift that I received today from Rabbi Bogopolsky, who has written a sefer based on the Torah of Rav Weinfeld, and it's called Timely and Timeless. The truth is I was feeling a little bit left out because he was putting it on his status every time he gifted it to someone. I happened to see him today. I said, you know, I haven't been on yet. So he whipped it out of his car, gave me a copy. And of course, it had to find its way into our 3 ideas in 30 minutes. Our learning tonight is sponsored generously by Marilyn and Michael Fedak in gratitude for the many weekly learning opportunities at BRS. We are very grateful to the Fedaks. And as always, our learning is an aliyah for the neshama of Esther Tehila Bas Gavriel Pinchas. Okay, this one I love. The Torah here from Timely and Timeless. Pasuk says, Vayavek Ishimo Adalos HaShachar, that of course, Yaakov, you could take a hot dog. Of course, Yaakov is battling with the Saro Shel Esav. In the Gemara in Maseches Chulin, as the Machlokes, who exactly was the Saro Shel Esav? One opinion was, or Shmuel Bar Nachmani, was that it was a Gentile. And Rav Bar Ula says that it appeared as a Torah scholar. So what is this talking about? What is the form of the evil inclination? What's the what format? What appearance did the Yetzirah to the Saro Shel Esav have at that moment in time? So first he points out something which I think is very beautiful, which is, why doesn't he know what it looks like? In other words, if I tell you, what does this table look like? You'll be able to describe the table. It's a brown table. It's got four legs. If I told you what the chair looks like, you would tell me, chances are, if it's a chair in Boker Raton Synagogue, it's got some blue, it's got some gold, it's got some chuln stains on it, right? You could tell us that, you know, what everything looks like. So what does it mean? What did the Saro Shel Esav look like? He looked like something. He either looked like a person, he looked like a table, a chair. What did he look like? So what's his ambiguity? So first he has a very beautiful idea, which is that the reason why the Yetzer Hara only appears to be a certain way, in other words, he couldn't identify the looks, was because it did not represent true reality. That in and of itself I love. It's a reminder to us that while Torah is MS, that while Torah is truth, everything else, what the Yetzer Hara tries to convince us, is all just a mirage. It's all a false reality. So much of what Western society and pop culture and social media tries to convince us is true, or is going to provide us with happiness, or is going to provide us with fulfillment, it's all a mirage. None of it is actually going to provide it for you. And that's why Yaakov is not able to identify the Saro Shel Esav, because falsehood is amorphous. In other words, it doesn't have reality. It only appears to be something, but it is not truly something. That's idea number one, which again, I think is just a very beautiful idea in and of itself, a reminder to us that everything that's not Torah or connected to Avodas Hashem is Sheker. And sometimes we get duped into thinking that things that are false are real. And that's what we have to constantly remind ourselves of. That's why Mussar learning is so important, because we have to constantly remind ourselves and recalibrate ourselves as to what is true and what is not true. But then he says, what does it mean that the Yetzer Hara, that the evil inclination, appeared as a Torah scholar? How could a Torah scholar be the evil inclination? Isn't the evil inclination something that's bad? When I envision the evil inclination, I envision the red guy over your shoulder with the pitchfork and the funny ears. What does it mean that it appears as a Torah scholar? So this is an idea we've developed in the past, but I think it's such a beautiful representation here as well. He quotes the Medrash. The Medrash says that when Hashem saw that all he had done, Vayar Tov Ma'od, he saw that it was very good. The Medrash teaches that Tov refers to good. That's the evil inclination. Ma'od is the Yetzer Hara. That's the evil inclination. I'm sorry, Ma'od, Tov is the good inclination. Ma'od is the evil inclination. Ask Rav Weinfeld, quoted by Rabbi Bogopolsky, how is the evil inclination alluded to in the word Ma'od? Ma'od means a lot. How does that refer to the evil inclination? He writes here the following, and it is so beautiful. He says, too much good is actually bad. One who attempts to become perfect will inevitably fail, and that failure can lead to despondency. In other words, if you think that the only options are perfection or bust, then you're going to be frustrated along the way, because perfection is unattainable. Life is filled with ups and downs. And if you get frustrated or despondent by every down, so you're going to fail. By being human, by definition, means embracing one's lack of perfection. Having someone try for me'od, having someone try for perfection, is a tactic of the Yetzirah. The Yetzirah, the evil inclination, tries to convince us to be perfect. It tries to convince us that if we can't get it that well, then why bother trying at all? It almost tries to convince us that Judaism is an all or nothing proposition. That is the evil inclination. It's the evil inclination that appears to someone like a Torah scholar, setting before them an unattainable vision of what they must become. So let's say I go to you and I say, you know, guys, there's no real point in learning Torah unless you're going to learn 5 hours a day. That's the Yetzirah talking, because it's not true. For some people, 5 hours is too little. For some people, 5 minutes is too much. It depends on the person, depends on who you are, where you come from, what your upbringing is. It's the Yetzirah that says, if you can't do it 5 hours a day, why bother trying at all? It's the Yetzirah that says that if you can't keep a Shmona Esrei, you're focused the entire time, why bother trying at all? That's the Ma'od. It tries to convince you to be perfect. It tries to convince you for aspirations that are beyond your capability necessarily. One sees that vision, realizes that they do not measure up, and just surrenders to failure. A person must remember that the mission is not to be like a Torah scholar, but to be an optimal version of oneself based on the skills and talents one has received from Hashem. It is not all or nothing. So no one expects me to be like Reb Schechter. No one says that, Moskowitz, if you can't be like Reb Schechter, why bother trying at all? You know why? Because I'm different than Reb Schechter. And I have different gifts and talents and abilities than Reb Schechter has. In his mind, I won't have. There are things he'll have that I'll never have. So I'm not going to compare myself to Reb Schechter. I'm not going to try to be like Reb Schechter. It's the Yetzirah that says that if you're not going to be like him, why bother trying at all? That is what it means that the Yetzirah appears like a Torah scholar. And now listen to what he says. Because what mitzvah do we have as a result of this story? We have the Gid Anasha, the sciatic nerve, which we're told we're not allowed to eat. Now, parenthetically, I saw a question today, which I thought was fascinating. Usually when something good happens in Judaism, or when something like this happens in Judaism, a mitzvah, a miracle, what do? We take on mitzvahs, right? So Pesach, we take on the mitzvah of matzah, we take on the mitzvah of dalat kosos. Purim, we take on the mitzvahs of shalach manos and of seudah. Chanukah, we take on the mitzvahs of lighting candles. What's the Gid Anasha? We're commemorating a miracle. Yaakov is saved from the Sar Shalisa. What? How do we do it? By doing nothing. Instead of doing something, we actually commemorate it by the absence of something. That in and of itself, I think, is a fascinating tidbit. But listen to what he says here. If that's the case, if the Saro Shalisav is the Yitzhara, and the Yitzhara is the Torah scholar, so what does the Gid Anasha have to do with it? So he writes here the following. What is the Gid Anasha? When Yaakov had his leg hit, what couldn't he do, or what did he have to do? He can only limp. He says, Yaakov left this encounter limping, which is why we do not eat the Gid Anasha. The Sefer Achinuch explains that with this mitzvah we recall that even though Yaakov left his encounter limping, he still persevered. He continued to walk in his limited state. And if that doesn't relate to you, I'd be surprised. I would venture to say that in all of our lives, there are times when we felt we were running, times we felt we were walking, and times we felt that the best we could do was limp. That we moved forward, but it was painful and required sacrifice. And it was difficult, and sometimes it was one step forward and two steps back. It felt like you were limping. And yet, Yaakov Avinu, even though he had that limp, what did he do? He continued moving forward. Was he as fast as he used to be? No. Was he as limber as he used to be? No. But he still moved forward. He writes here, making progress, even when you cannot be perfect, is the real challenge. So we think progress has to be stratospheric. And progress always has to be linear. It's not the case. This is really the story of the Jewish people. Even though we are hated and attacked, we do not surrender and throw in the towel. We continue pushing through. And that is the story of the Jewish people. After the Holocaust, when it was so easy for us to have thrown up our hands and just quit, what happens? Jews came to America, they came to Eretz Yisrael, and they built Torah institutions, they rebuilt Torah life. If I had woken someone up in 1945 and told them the Torah would be through, you wouldn't have believed it. But it's because we pushed through, we put one foot in front of the other. Were we running after the Holocaust? Absolutely not. You know what it was? It was a limp, but we put one foot in front of the other, and that's how we did it. And I promise you, this is such important inspiration and chizuk in our own personal lives as well. There are times when we are incapable of running. There are times that even though we want to run, we just can't. And you know what we do? We limp. But there's a value in the limping. The Gid Anasha reminds us that even when the best you can do is limp, sometimes that's good enough. And there's a Yetzirah. There's a Yetzirah. There's an evil inclination of the Torah scholar that comes along and says, you're limping? That's the best you could do? You're nice, Farv. What's the problem? Why bother trying? Surrender to failure. Give in to despondency. But the mitzvah of the Gidon Asher reminds us that even when the best you can do is limp, that's how you push through. And you might not run the marathon in 2 hours and 10 minutes. It might take you 15 hours. But you're going to continue to put one foot in front of the other. You will not stop. You will continue to persevere, even if it means you are in a limited state, even if it means you can only do so by limping. But the calling card of a Jew is that we push through nonetheless. And that's why Yaakov becomes Yisrael at the time, because that's what it means to be a Jew. That's what's carried us through Jewish history. And ultimately, I think it is important, very important chizuk for every single one of us. That's idea number one from Timely and Timeless, Rabbi Bogopolsky. I'm grateful for his idea. Any latecomers, please enjoy yourself to a hot dog from our hot dog cart. Okay, idea number two comes from Rav, the Drash Mordechai, which is Rav Mordechai Druk, which is the Rav Druk, I think that Rabbi Goldberg quotes all the time, his father. He writes here, it's a word from Parshas Vayetze, but it applies very much to Parshas Vayishlach as well. Okay, Yaakov Avinu is coming back, of course, Vayashkem Yaakov Baboker. Yaakov Avinu at the beginning of our parsha is saying how they should split up the camps, and he says that one of the miracles when he looks around, he says, that all I used to have was a staff, and now shtei machanos. Now I have two camps. And Yaakov Avinu is essentially reflecting upon the miracle of his life. He's saying that there was a time when all I had was a staff. That was the staff that we encounter here in this pasuk, which was Parshas Vayetze. Vayashkem Yaakov baboker v'yikachas even asher samei rashosav. Okay, so Yaakov had his staff. And now that he's reflecting on the miracle of his life, he says, it's amazing. There was a time when all I had was a staff. And now look at me. I have a family, and I have sheep, and I have goats, and I have the whole kit and caboodle. I'm driving the Mercedes right now. Okay, that was Yaakov's reflection at the beginning of Parsha. And that's why it's preceded by the pasuk of Katonti. Yaakov says, what did I do to deserve this? All I had was a staff, and now I have an abundance of blessing. But if you look back, is that true that all Yaakov had was a staff? At the beginning of last week's parsha, I'm going to read you the pasuk. Vayashkem Yaakov baboker v'yikachas even asher samei rashosav. Yaakov took the rock that was under his head. Vayasim oso matseva. He transforms it into a matseva. Vayitzok shemen al rosha, and he takes oil and he pours oil on top of it. Asked Rav Druk, wait a second. I thought Yaakov, you said ki b'makli avar asei adinazeh, that all you had Yaakov was a staff. Where did the oil come from? You could say, okay, the Torah didn't mention everything, right? L'chor, he had clothes on, right? Okay, so the Torah just picked out the staff. Well, by now he has stuff. He was referring to Parshas Vayetze. He said, all I had was a staff. But we see in Parshas Vayetze, he had more than a staff. He had Vayatzek Shaman Al Rosho. He had oil. So if the Torah's...
Maybe he made it.
Maybe he made it when?
David has plenty of olive trees.
Okay, so maybe he made it. But then he should have said, I used to have a staff and I had access to oil. Right? In other words, if I were telling you that all I had yesterday was... there was nothing in the house. All I had was, you know, water. So, if I had Gatorade also, you would say, why didn't you mention the Gatorade? Oh, why? Because it was in the closet? Okay, but like, it's still accessible to me. So that's Rav Druk's kasha. Listen to his answer, it's so beautiful. He says, Yaakov had the oil also. But you know where the oil was hidden? The oil was hidden in the staff. You see, Yaakov hollowed out his staff, and he filled it with oil. Now, why would Yaakov hollow out his staff and fill it with oil? What do you do with oil? We're about to do it in a few weeks. What do we light with oil? We light candles. Why would Yaakov light a candle? What do you need a candle for? What did Yaakov want to do, says Rav Druk? He wanted to learn Torah. There's a problem. He was all alone. Do you understand what it was like back then? We were in Nevada last year, and we were driving back from a place called Death Valley, which it's an interesting name for a place, but okay, it's called Death Valley. And we're driving back late at night, and we pulled over on the side of the road, and when I say there wasn't a light, as not only as far as the eye could, for miles and miles and miles, I've never seen stars in my life like that. It was pitch black, so much so that it took minutes for my eyes to adjust back and forth from light to darkness, because it was pitch black like I'd never experienced before ever. So here Yaakov Avinu, he's on his own, he's on a run. he wants to be able to learn Torah, but how is he going to learn Torah? So he hollows out the one thing that he has, and what does he do? He fills it with oils so that he'll be able to light the candle at night and be able to learn Torah. That's what Rav Druk says. He says, Temua, me'ifo haya lo shemen litzok. Where did Yaakov have the oil in last week's Parsha? He quotes the Bali Atosvos, she'makel shelo haya chalol v'haya bo shemen, that it was hollowed out and it had oil in it, kedei lilmo Torah b'layla me'ashemen hazeh, to be able to learn Torah. And he says, from that oil, Moshe Rabbeinu as a Mishkan v'kelev, that was the oil that was used to anoint the vessels of the Mishkan. Ala shemen hazeh, Elisha amar pacha shemen lo techala. That was the miracle with Elisha in the oil. V'ashemen hazeh hu ha-shemen shenimsa chasum b'chos moshe kohen gadol b'chanukah. And the little pacha shemen, the little amount of oil that we find on Chanukah, says Rav Druk, it's the oil that goes all, or says the Bali Atosos, it's the oil that goes all the way back to Yaakov. It's the oil that goes all the way back to Yaakov.
So what's the nace of Pach Shemin that this thing's been known for 800 years?
Maybe that's the nace.
But they already knew that it continues to provide oil.
Hold on, let me just finish it and then we'll. So he says here, and that's the Shemin that's going to be used for Mashiach. He says, now you understand something that we say in Geshem. Geshem, we say, which one? I always forget which one's Tal, which one's Geshem. Geshem, we just said, right?
Just said.
Yeah. So in Geshem, we say a line.
No,
we say Mesein Tal and Matar.
Yeah,
okay. So he says, Zechor Ta'an Miklo Ve'avar Yardein Maim. The last line got cut off. That's what we say. One of the things we ask Hashem for is to remember the person who carried his stick and crossed the Yardein. What is it to remember that Yaakov had a stick? That's what Hashem should remember. What's the graisa chesed that Hashem, like, remember I got dressed this morning, Hashem. Okay, like, what's the big deal? No, says the Bali Atosos. What we're remembering isn't the stick. It was that with the one thing Yaakov had, he chose to hollow it out to make sure they had oil to learn Torah. And that's what we're remembering. So why do I love this idea so much? Okay, so Yaakov had a staff, and he hollowed it out, and he filled it with oil. That's how he was able to learn Torah. And that's what we remember on Chanukah, and that's what we remember. What I find is so beautiful is I hope it gives every single one of us an appreciation. You see, Yaakov had every excuse in the book why not to learn. Got dark, 5:30, whenever it got dark in Eretz Yisrael today, Yaakov could have said, bedtime, schluff, they didn't have Netflix back then, so they had to go straight to sleep. Right, he had nothing to do. He could have very easily folded up, you know, and said, I'm going to bed right now. What does Yaakov do instead? Yaakov, with his one possession, says, I'm making sure that I have the ability to learn Torah. And I want every single one of us to appreciate the Mesiras Nefesh that Yaakov had. That's what we commemorate on Chanukah. Chanukah is not just about lighting candles. The Chazal tells us it's the holiday of Torah Shebaal Peh. It's the holiday of the Oral Torah. What does it mean, the holiday of the Oral Torah? So according to Rav Druk, what it means is it's a holiday that we remember how lucky we are to be able to learn Torah. How lucky we are. Chevra, it has never been easier in world history to access Torah. If you speak Hebrew, obviously you have Hebrew. If you don't speak Hebrew, Art Scroll has made Torah accessible. If you speak French, Art Scroll has made it accessible. If you speak Spanish, Art Scroll has made it accessible. If you only online Safari, you have Daf Yomi, the Art Scroll app that was on sale last week. There are so many resources that we have now that are literally unprecedented in Jewish history. And so if Yaakov Avinu, with his last remaining possession, the only thing he wanted to do was hollow it out to make sure that he would be able to learn Torah, I want all of us to appreciate how easy it is and accessible it is for us. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to happen easily. We still have to put in the effort. We still have to show up. And sometimes learning Torah means that we have to make ourselves vulnerable. Because after all, in my professional career, I could be very successful, but when I come into a base medrash, I feel like a two-year-old anymore. I don't have the background, I don't have the history. Okay. Yaakov, with his last possession, Kibimakli, with my stick. What did he choose to do with it? Make sure that he can learn Torah. It's a reminder of how we choose our possessions, that they're a conduit to be able to learn Torah, but it's also a reminder to us of, you know, the Gemara says that certain people are mechayiv other people. They obligate other people. So I think Yaakov obligates us. If Yaakov was willing to go to those extent, to that length, to be able to learn Torah, then I think all of us, whether it's Art Scroll, whether it's Safaria, whether it's, you know, the Rabbi Steinsaltz, whatever it is, I don't care. There are so many resources available to us, and we should be willing to use it. But I love the question also. If you only had the stick, where was the oil? The answer is that the oil was in the stick. That is idea number two. So idea number one came from Rabbi Bogopolsky, timely and timeless, the Yetzer Hara. Judaism is not all or nothing. And that's the Gittin Asha, to remind us that even when we limp along, it's progress, and we should be grateful for that progress. Number two, from Rav Druk, the idea of the staff being hollowed out, having oil, and a reminder to us that we should take advantage of the access that we have to Talmud Torah. And idea number three comes from definitely not a source we've had until now, and that is Rav Rimon's wife. Ooh, wow. Rav Rimon's wife. I hope I don't get put in the cheirim for this. Rav Rimon's wife has an unbelievably beautiful essay online. And I want to share, this is not even like an excerpt. It's like shrunk down. It's a whole long piece, and I'm boiling it down for you. Of course, where's Rachel buried? So we find out that Rachel is buried where? Derech, right, Derech Ephrasa, the pasuk, right? So she's buried on the way. So why isn't she buried in Maras Machpelah with everybody else? Right, that's the million-dollar question. And the Mefarshim are split between, was it that it was just convenient, that Lemaisa, that's where she passed away, and so he didn't want to delay, so he buried right there, or was it purposeful? And we all know the Medrash, Rachel Mevakal Baneha. Rachel needs to be on the way because she's going to cry for our descendants as we go into exile. Rachel, Mama Rachel is going to be crying for us, and so that's why she had to be buried on the way. Rebbetzin Rimon wants to know, is there something deeper about the fact that she's buried on the way? Like, what a strange description. Even if you wanted to tell me that she had to be buried away from everybody else because she was going to cry for... Why describe it as on the way? What a very strange description. So he writes here the following, in the third bold you have there. What is the significance of Rachel dying in childbirth? And she develops the idea that if you look throughout Rachel's life, everything happens almost. In other words, it never reaches its conclusion. It's never perfect. So Yaakov works for her for 7 years. What happens? Leah jumps in, or Lavan dupes them, right? Then there's friction with Leah. Then Leah starts having children and Rachel is infertile, right? So nothing goes exactly as planned for Rachel's life. Then all of a sudden she's finally going to have the child, which is the fulfillment of everything she's been yearning for and everything she's been craving for. And what happens? She dies in childbirth. So she wants to know, what is the significance of Rachel dying in childbirth? And she says, it's this idea, Chevra, is so beautiful. She says, Rachel never reaches the conclusion, the rest after the journey. Her whole life is a journey, in other words, but she never reaches the conclusion. Rather, she remains suspended in the process, the journey. She's buried on the way. She remains suspended in that journey. She does give birth. She's not barren until the end of her life, but she does not have the opportunity to realize her motherhood. It seems that Rachel's entire existence symbolizes the way, or the process. Her life is a story of constantly grappling with process. And it is from Rachel that we learn the significance of process. Something that is attained easily is of lesser value in a person's eyes. When a person lacks something, he has a better understanding of its value. When he must work hard for something in order to attain, he appreciates it more and it is more attached to it. In addition, the very process that he undergoes, even if he never achieves his final objective, causes his personality to grow and develop. We know that to be true. Chevro, you know that the things you worked hardest on, even if you didn't actually achieve it, there's a certain satisfaction and meaning and geschmack that is found in the fact that you put in the effort to it, irrespective of whether you actually got to the destination. And therefore, she says on page number 5, Rachel, our matriarch, symbolizes the process. It is the one best suited to pray for exiled children. Right, why? Okay, now we understand. Rachel represents the journey. She represents the process. She represents focus on the sweat and tears of getting there, irrespective of whether you actually hit the destination. If that's the case, why is it Rachel Mevakel Baneha? Why is it that Rachel is the one who cries as we go into exile? And so she writes, being led into exile may be interpreted as the end of the process. There was a bond between the Jewish people and Hashem. The covenant was violated, and that the result is the severance of relationships with God. You could have very easily said after the Holocaust, that's it. The relationship's over. We're done. Severed, divorced, no longer. B'nai Yisrael are led into exile where they would disappear amongst the nations. Rachel, however, symbolizing the process, represents the hope that this exile is only part of a process, not its conclusion. Rachel pleads to Hashem that the exile should be a station along the way and not an end. Her death on the way and her burial on the way, therefore, symbolize an entire life that is on the way, in the midst of a process, aspiring to achieve. Rachel symbolizes the importance of process, is worthy of being the matriarch who pleads before Hashem on behalf of the exiled children, asking that their exile should be a part of the process, not its ending, that the exile should lead to redemption in return. Rachel's death on the way is not incidental, but rather symbolic of the essence of her life. That's so powerful. Rachel's entire life is defined as never reaching its conclusion. She is defined by what we would call the journey, what we would call the process. And she develops two beautiful ideas out of this. Number one, in our own personal lives, it's a reminder that it's not about the end, but it's about the process that we take to get there. That there's a certain beauty in putting an effort into something, and that we value that irrespective of whether we actually get there. That's why, by the way, according to many of the Mefarshim, why is Yushalayim never mentioned in the Torah? Spoiler alert, you'll never find the word Yushalayim in Chamisha Chumshei Torah. It appears in Tanakh. Right? How does it refer to Yushalayim? Over and over and over again in Parshas Vayera and Parshas Re'eh, El Ha Makom, to the place. Why didn't it say El Yushalayim? The answer is because Judaism de-emphasizes the result and emphasizes the journey and the process to get there. Yushalayim is never mentioned because it's not about whether we get there or not. It's about our journey to get there. Think about the fact. Think about the fact that... Okay, but anyways, that's what Rachel's talking about here. Rachel is a process, journey type person. Oh, what was I going to say? Rabbi Sacks has a beautiful idea. Rabbi Sacks writes that the Torah, Tanakh, is the only book ever written that has no ending. That it's always for the future. Right? Sefer Bereishis ends. Where would you envision Sefer Bereishis ending? They're all trying to get to Eretz Yisrael. You would envision Sefer Bereishis ending with all the Shvatim, all the sons, happily ever after in Eretz Yisrael. Where does Bereishis end? Not at its end. They're still on the journey. Then you come to the end of the Torah, right? And you think, okay, the end of the Torah, it's going to be, every, you know, every book has a happily ever after. So you think the Torah is going to have a, where does Moshe Rabbeinu finish the Torah? Does he get to Eretz Yisrael? No, it's on the cusp. It's on the precipice of Eretz Yisrael, but he doesn't actually get in. If you look at the end of Divrei Hayamim, Divrei Hayamim ends with the Jewish people about to return to Eretz Yisrael in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, but they don't actually get there, right? The entire Torah is not a book of endings, but it's a book of the journey and the messages that we get to write the next chapter. That's what Rabbi Sacks writes. But says Rabbitzin Rimon, that's what's encapsulated by Rachel. So on our personal lives, it's a reminder that we're all on a journey and we're all part of a process, and we should focus less on the results and the end game and more on the beauty and the effort that it takes us to get there. But then she says it's also about us as a people. Why is Rachel uniquely qualified to cry for the Jewish people? Because it's Rachel who understands that Gullus is going to be a process, that Hashem doesn't sever the relationship. It's not the end. It's not, you know, pull the curtains and show's over. But rather, we are part of a process, an exile that's going to lead to Geula, and to return. And so therefore, Rachel is the perfect person to symbolize that, because that was her life. Her life wasn't about the end. Her life was about the journey to get to the end. I see your Davidel's here already. I don't want to go into his time, but you should help yourself. We have a hot dog machine. First week. Please help yourself to a hot dog machine while I summarize our three ideas. Idea number one came from Rabbi Bogopolsky, timely and timeless. The Yetzer Hara is the Talmud Chacham. The Yetzer Hara tries to convince us to be perfect. The Yetzer Hara tries to convince us that Judaism is all or nothing. It's not. And that's why Yaakov Avinu walks away with a limp, to remind us that even when we have to limp along, even when we're not able to run, and we're not sometimes even able to walk, and the best we can do is to put out a limp, but that there's still value, and that's still progress, and that's still pushing us forward, and that's what we have to do. Our job is to persevere and push through, even when it's hard, and even when it feels like we are limping along. Idea number two comes from Rav Druk, from Mordechai Druk, who says, what does it mean? Keep a makli, all I had was a staff. So if he has staff, where did the oil come from in the beginning of Ayetzeh? He quotes the Tosos, who says that no, Yaakov hollowed out his staff to put the oil in there so he could learn Torah at night. And if that was the sacrifice and the Mesiras Nefesh that Yaakov was going to have for Torah, then all of us, Chevra, it's so easy for us. Art school has robbed us of any excuses not to learn Torah. Everything is translated into English. It is so accessible nowadays. Yaakov had to jump through hula hoops. We just have to go online and it's accessible to us. And idea number three is, what does it mean that Rachel was on the way? Why is her entire life encapsulated by that idea, on the way? And we developed the idea that that is who Rachel was. Rachel is not about the end, but about the journey and the process that it takes to get there, and the lesson that that has in our personal lives, and also the lesson that it has as us as a people. And we as a people are in the midst of a process. We are in the Aschalta de Geula. It is the beginnings of the redemption. And that process, that journey is going to have ups and downs. It has its ups and downs. It's going to continue to have ups and downs. But lest we ever give up hope for a second, because we get frustrated. Where's the end? Where's the goal? We want to get there. We have to look to Mama Rachel and to remember that life is about the journey and the process. And with the emunah in that, and with the faith that exile is sometimes a limp, and sometimes a run, and sometimes it's one step forward, and sometimes it's one step back. But we are, Mirtz Hashem, on the way and on the road to the Geula and to the redemption. B'mheira, b'yameinu. Everyone's invited to stay.